Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We'll call our third case for today, 02-2137, State v. And how do you pronounce the defendant's name?
Lagundoye.
Lagundoye. We have argument by Attorney Mwangi, and then Mr. Frymuth, whom we saw earlier today, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal by Mr. Mwangi. Counsel, you may proceed.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, Honorable Associate Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court, I'm very honored to be here. This is my first oral argument before any Supreme Court, and the last time I appeared here, I was being sworn in as this really green lawyer, and this makes me very nervous, and it's a nerve-wracking experience waiting to sign in and then to come before this august body. I appreciate the courts having granted our petition. This is a sad case because my client was deported, and it is one of those cases that reminds me of what a great opportunity it is to be a citizen of this country, because millions dream about it but never get it, and millions come here through either petitions filed by family or petitions filed by employers. And I looked at the visa bulletin and noticed that for the Philippines, petitions filed by U.S. citizens who have brothers and sisters left behind in the Philippines 22 years ago are now able to have those brothers and sisters file their applications to get their green cards. People are waiting 22 years just for a chance to come to America. Some others come here because we're their last hope to life and liberty, because they're tortured, persecuted, facing death because of their race, because of their religion, because of their gender. And we take them in because we are America. For some, it's an opportunity because they're orphans to have a home, to have a parent. And for some, it's to rejoin their family. For a third grader known as Olayinka Kazim Lagundoye, coming to America happened December 5th of 1984. Bright-eyed with his mom, younger brother, and sister, he came to Milwaukee through O'Hare. He joined Milwaukee Public Schools, went to high school, and then to University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He was growing up, disagreed with his parents, and left home and thought, you know, I can fend for myself. But then he realized it's not that easy, and he sought a part-time job working for an electronics store, and then he made some bad choices. He decided, you know, to pay for life, I'm going to stole $106 from his employer's till. Then he tried to steal CD players and some speakers, was caught before he even left the parking lot of that store. Then he forged signatures of customers on credit card slips, and he was busted. He went before the Milwaukee County Circuit Court, and he thought he got a bargain, and he was going to be locked up, yes, but he could do that and then get out and rejoin the citizens of the great state of Wisconsin and become productive again. What he didn't know and what he wasn't told was that in that bargain was this hidden truth, which is deportation. Now, the legislature of the state...
Also, I thought that the plea questionnaire did have a statement that that was a possibility. I mean, I agree, at least from my reading of the record, that the judge didn't tell him that.
Justice Abrahamson, that is correct. And he did sign a plea questionnaire, but this court has held in Duangmala that the legislature elected, and that is the legislature's right to do, that it is important, that it is required that the court tell non-citizens that in addition to whatever bargain they've cut with the state, deportation is a possibility. As Justice Jackson of the United States Supreme Court dissented in Jordan versus DeGeorge in 1951, respondent, because he's an alien and because he has been twice convicted of crimes the court holds involve moral turpitude, is punished with life, with a life sentence of banishment in addition to punishment which a citizen would suffer for the identical acts. The legislature of the state of Wisconsin in 1985 decided that this is important enough to create a separate section of that statute which requires courts as part of the plea colloquy to warn these non-citizens that in addition to whatever you think bargain you've got, there is a possibility you will be banished. Now, the state argues that allowing a defendant to withdraw a guilty plea or no contest plea because no oral deportation warning was given says nothing about the fairness of the underlying conviction. Well,
are we going to talk about the fairness, or I want to just ask a question then. There were three convictions, and they were over a period of time, 96 and to 98. I noticed that that there was no evidence that there was an appeal on the burglary or theft conviction, but there was an appeal on the forgery conviction. Is that's correct?
That is correct, Justice Wilcox.
My question is that... Now, those were completed, and that's the question before us, whether or not those convictions were in the so-called pipeline. And to be, in other words, in the pipeline, would they be eligible for some retroactivity by this court? But these were already completed. Does it make any difference? What if the convictions were back 5 years before that? Would that make any difference?
Justice Wilcox, the problem with that argument, and I understand your argument to be the finality of the judgment should affect whether or not Section 97108, subparagraph 2, should be applied to that judgment of conviction.
And Dramoga was a new rule of this court. And the court, I think it was a unanimous opinion, as I recall, of this court.
My problem with agreeing or conceding that argument is that knowing what I know about how the Immigration Department works, they are not permitted to use as predicate any judgment that's not final. And if that is the guiding principle, then what is the remedy in 97108 subparagraph 2? Because the people who need it cannot get it because they are not faced with deportation until after their convictions are final. Now, there's another class, as Justice Jackson points out. Crimes involving moral turpitude don't necessarily trigger deportation if you only have one. If you have two, then you have a problem in many cases. Now, until you have the second one, you won't have a problem. Now, the first one becomes final, years pass, and then you have a second one, and then you have a problem, yet you're not permitted to go back and vacate the first one. Now, these days after September 11, we have an additional problem that a small incident like a broken taillight can trigger an encounter with the Immigration Department. Now, everything in the past is at play, and the Immigration Department can then seek deportation proceedings against a person who, say, in 1999 thought, this is final, I'm done with it, but suddenly finds himself or herself facing deportation that they never thought was part of whatever bargain they entered into when they entered the plea they entered, which then led to a conviction that became final then.
Are you indicating that was part of a bargain in your client's case, that there was a bargain that he entered into and that he was not guilty of the charges? That's why I brought up the fact that there was an appeal in the one case. But the issue is whether or not this should be retroactive, in other words, to a final action.
I see the two things, Your Honor, as separate, because at a particular moment when a defendant is considering whether to give up his right to remain silent, whether to give up his right to put the state to its strictest proof, whether to give up his right to trial by a jury of his peers, he's considering what is at stake and what he gets in exchange for giving up those rights. Now, the calculus for him is, I can go away for a couple of years, after which I go free. But if he's told that not only do you go away for a couple of years, as Justice Jackson points out, you go away for the rest of your life, that's a different consideration for this defendant. If you tell him that you will be banished to a country where recently a woman was sentenced to death by stoning because she had a child out of wedlock, where this young man's family tells me he was mugged because the people who mugged him hate Americans, he dresses like an American, sounds like an American, he would have stopped to think, is this really a bargain? Because after all, in exchange for his plea, which he thinks is getting him this 2-year or whatever sentence he was getting, which is finite, he's also getting the rest of his life banishment in Nigeria. Now, if you tell him all those facts, now his plea is knowing, it is intelligent, and it is voluntary. And that is what makes the conviction fair. And observing this warning as part of the procedures is what's implicit in the conduct of ordered liberty. And that's the mainstay of our justice system, which is what sets us apart from the rest of the world. And so if we insist that we cannot apply Duang Mala retroactively simply because on a particular day the judgment of conviction became final, we are focusing on something different from whether or not we believe what happened was fundamentally fair. Justice Harlan, in his concurrence in the Williams and Mackey cases in 1971, said a fundamentally fair proceeding should stand up under an old rule as it would under a new rule. And so we shouldn't worry about whether the convictions are going to be disturbed or not under different rules. If it was fundamentally fair then, it should strike us fundamentally fair under Duang Mala. And so applying Duang Mala retroactively should concern us less if we believe that this young man was fairly convicted. And the only reason we should worry about it is if he was unfairly convicted. And so my sense is, and I urge this honorable court to adopt it, is that it is only fair if he knows that in addition to these 8 years concurrent sentences he got, he also has been told he will be banished potentially. And I think that's what the gist of our case is about.
Now, the law in this area, generally speaking, is if it's a procedural right, you don't have to make it retroactive. Substantive right, generally do. You're not arguing that. You're arguing a basic fairness concept, not on due process, I assume. Not a constitutional concept of due process, fairness.
Your Honor, you're right. It is fairness, and because the legislature and this court has said, the legislature has elected the procedure, this is the procedure the legislature has elected, it has to be followed. It is not a substantive right in the sense of, does it go to the criminal process itself, in the sense of, does it make conduct a crime? No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm arguing. But it's a procedural issue, I believe, and in that sense, I believe, in the scheme of ordered liberty, I believe my argument is about the fairness, and if a plea is going to be voluntary, I think my client cannot be said to have entered a voluntary plea if the legislature requires that he be told about the potential for being banished, and he was not told about the potential for being banished.
No, when we get to voluntary, our usual procedure is, even if the record on its face does not show it's knowing and voluntary, the plea, we send it back for a hearing. And if at that hearing it turns out that there's proof that he did know and it was voluntary, even though the record at the trial court leaves much to be desired, let us say, then he can't withdraw the plea. So are you asking, I don't think so, are you asking that we have a hearing, a Bangert-type hearing, to see if he really knew? I mean, that's sort of a loser for you because of the plea questionnaire.
No, Your Honor.
Not a lawyer.
No, Your Honor, that's not what we're asking for because this court has held in Duang Mahler and the state has conceded harmless error analysis has no place under Section 97108, subparagraph 2. We're not asking for that.
As you say, your client is no longer in this country. Suppose you win. What does it do for him?
And, Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that question because, as I noticed in the synopsis on this court's website and the summary outside for the public, it is an error to argue that it makes no difference. It makes a world of difference because he was deported because of the convictions. If the convictions are vacated, and federal law has affirmed this, Sandoval versus the INS, a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals case, holds that the state court is the final arbiter of what is a valid conviction under state law. If this court vacates the convictions, the deportation might as well never happen. And he can then march into the consulate in Lagos, and based upon his dad's approved petition for him for a green card, apply to be admitted into the United States. He will need a waiver, and it's not as simple as I'm stating it, but I will assist him to get the waiver because his mom, his dad, his two sisters, and his brother all are U.S. citizens, and it would be a hardship for them to support him in Nigeria. And yes, it would be an uphill struggle, but I am signed up for that, and I would help him to try and get that waiver. Yes, affirmatively, yes, it makes a difference, and he would be eligible to be admitted into the United States.
Suppose he, after, I assume, great struggle and time, gets back, is he subject to prosecution?
I believe, Your Honor, he would be if the state so elected to do.
Did you indicate that his parents are citizens?
That is correct, Your Honor.
He came over when he was about 8 years old?
I believe he was 9 years old.
Why didn't the young man become a citizen?
At that point, his father was a student on an F-1 visa, and his parents did not become citizens until later. And at that point, he was not living at home, and he was having his problems. And that is the reason why he did not become a citizen. And at the point at which they became citizens, he was over the age of 18, and so the automatic law of automatic citizenship did not apply to him because he was over 18. And so his brothers and sisters did automatically become citizens, but he was over that age and could not.
So you ultimately fall back on it's only fair, and what we did for Mr. Duwamangi, we should do for your client.
Your Honor, if this court did that, I would be eternally grateful on my client's behalf.
Would there be any incentive for the state to retry him?
Your Honor, I wouldn't presume to speak for the state. I hope not, because I think the state has exacted its pound of flesh from this young man.
But he would have waived a statute of limitations by seeking an overturn, I would assume. Being out of the country, maybe the statute of limitations doesn't apply while he's out, so that's gone. I suppose you've got a problem just of proof with witnesses gone and et cetera.
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question, I must concede.
My problem here is this. You have created a very appealing case for this young man.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Of course, it is not the court that decides what the immigration law is, the deportation law. We don't decide that. My concern is if we say that this rule is a component of ordered liberty, what ramifications that would have in a whole slew of other cases.
Your Honor, as I cited to Sandoval versus the INS, the Seventh Circuit has held, and I believe there are other precedents in other circuits, and the United States Supreme Court is also on record on that issue. If the federal government wishes to use as predicate for deportation state convictions, it has to yield to the state's judgment as to what is a valid conviction. If this court holds that Yinka's conviction is not valid, that is the final decision. And whatever it does, I think, is less important than whether or not Yinka's conviction is valid or not. And I am less concerned about what happens elsewhere than what happens in the case at hand. And I don't know what the federal government would do, to tell you the truth, Justice Prosser, and I don't think that that should decide how the court rules in Yinka's case. I think the court should rule as the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin, as it would rule on Wisconsin law as the final arbiter of what Wisconsin law is, regardless of how the Immigration Department of the United States would react. They're going to react whichever way they react, and that has nothing to do with what Wisconsin law is. And if they intend to use Wisconsin judgments as predicates, they have to yield to whatever the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin says is a valid conviction under Wisconsin law.
What I'm really getting at is what the precedential effect of a favorable ruling would be on retroactivity of what might be considered a new rule.
I don't know the answer to that question, Justice Prosser, to tell you the truth. I don't think there is going to be an avalanche of cases because I don't imagine that there are that many cases that would be affected. Remember, this affects non-citizens who are faced with deportation. Already, there are many cases in which there's really little you can do because the court warned the non-citizen as required by the legislature. If the trial court complied, what is your basis for vacating the judgment? There isn't one. In those cases where the trial court did not comply with the legislature's mandate, the just and fair thing to do is to vacate the judgment. And so, yes, I don't know the answer to that question, but I think the fair thing to do is to grant vacater where the warning was not given. And I don't believe that there are thousands of those kinds of cases because I don't imagine that there are that many people in Yinka's situation who would be seeking that kind of remedy. And that is just my opinion, and I see a lot of people needing my assistance, and when I try to see how many of those cases I have. They're not that many, and I have colleagues who deal with the same kind of issue. There are some, but I don't believe there are that many cases. And I don't have the numbers because I haven't done the statistics, and I don't know who has.
Thank you, Mr. Mwangi. We'll now hear from the Assistant Attorney General, James M. Freimuth, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Freimuth.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state of Wisconsin. The narrow question in this case is the retroactivity issue. Should the petitioner be allowed to take advantage of what I've called the automatic plea withdrawal rule, could also be called the no harmless error rule of Duang Mala, even though his three criminal cases all had become final when Duang Mala was decided on June 19, 2002. There are three possible legal issues bearing on resolution of that question, and the state would ask the court to hold as follows. First, although Mr. Lagundoy has now been deported, the state has conceded that this case should be decided, that it's not moot, both because of the potential for the petitioner to seek to reopen deportation proceedings should his pleas be withdrawn, and because the issue of retroactivity is going to recur, I believe. The second issue that the court could decide but wouldn't necessarily have to is one that the state also has conceded here, and that is the timing of the plea withdrawal motion itself. And I think it's important to keep in mind the difference between when a motion for plea withdrawal has to be made and the issue, the separate issue of whether the Duang Mala holding is retroactive or not. The statute 97108 only says later. It doesn't really specify when. And in our brief, the state has suggested a reasonable time. The two requirements for plea withdrawal is absence of an oral deportation warning at the plea colloquy, and the defendant has to show that his plea is likely to result in, is the statutory language, in one of the deportation consequences. So it seems to me that whatever kind of timing rule is going to be recognized for the plea withdrawal motion, it probably is going to be tied into when the defendant can reasonably show it's likely to result in a plea consequence.
You wrote us a letter on October 9th where you've kind of changed what you said in your brief, and now you seem like you're back to where you were in your brief.
No, I'm suggesting that this is a question that I think is an open question. In the brief, we argued for a reasonable due diligence type of proposition. I'm wondering if, depending on what likely to result in, could mean that, for example, in the case of an aggravated felony, my understanding is that's presumed deportable under immigration law. So it could be argued that it's only going to be timely for a defendant to seek plea withdrawal within the confines of a direct appeal, because he's going to know that if he's pleading to an aggravated felony, that, and I'm assuming here that there is proof that he knows the consequences, that there's no reason why he couldn't have brought it within the time of a direct appeal. Or if you want to take it, give him more leeway, as I understand, and again, my understanding of immigration law here is very, very limited, but the deportation proceedings are supposed to be initiated, as I understand it, before the defendant is out of custody, out of incarceration. So that also could be a fixed point at which you say, and that either there's a presumption. I would hesitate to suggest that this is a jurisdictional type of time limit for filing a motion, because the statute doesn't provide for it. So it's just not clear whether or not there should be some kind of presumption, perhaps, that it should be brought within the time that the defendant is in custody. In this case, this defendant was still on probation with respect to the last of the three convictions. So if you imported federal habeas custody meaning, he could go back and challenge even the earlier ones, because they're part of a string of sentences. I just think it's a knotty question, and I'm not sure that it necessarily has to be decided in this case. If it's not jurisdictional and we're conceding that it's timely, the court wouldn't have to wrestle with it here, but there may be an occasion where somebody's going to say, this is too old, this is too long. Perhaps the due diligence test that we suggested in our brief will be good enough if you consider that defendants will not, once they know that deportation proceedings have been initiated, they're not likely to sit on a plea withdrawal motion if that's their way of avoiding deportation. So perhaps it will not be as much of an issue as at least some of my colleagues were concerned about, our position being as open-ended as it is.
Now, how many people are presently in prison, do you know, who have made any motions? You do know, and there are a few.
Yeah, I do not know. The only anecdotal information I have, Milwaukee County was concerned about this, and one of the prosecutors called because he does have a case that will be controlled by your decision in this case. But I don't know about, if you're asking about numbers of potential non-immigrant cases that could be affected, I don't know.
I want to know the ones that are in prison now, and maybe if you could, although I would think they would be fewer, the ones that have been deported.
Right. I could look for that, but I don't know. I mean, I don't have it now, certainly, but I could certainly investigate for you.
Counsel, there seems a bit of a disconnect, and maybe you can connect it for me. The argument you advance is there's no reason that he could not have brought this in the time span of his direct appeal. Let me suggest that I'll put a hypothetical spin on it. Defendant commits a felony, gets 3 years, and considers it a good deal. Why would he appeal it? Why would why would he appeal that? Why would he appeal the deal and ask for a plea withdrawal?
Probably not, unless there were, unless at that point in the process, there was something that the immigration, you know, the federal government immigration did something that would spawn, you know, spawn him to do it. That's what prompted my initial position in the brief, is that until that happens, even though he may know that he is likely to result in, once the federal government discovers this, and I don't know how the federal government investigates and determines when a state convict is close to being no longer in custody, such that immigration proceedings will be initiated against that person. I think under your hypothetical, you're right. I mean, there would be no reason to appeal in terms of any other consequence, perhaps.
But if he hasn't appealed...
Excuse me?
If he hasn't appealed and asked to withdraw... I mean, it just, it's hard for me to have this mapped out in my mind. I'm a defendant, and I say, okay, 3 years sounds like a good deal. I'm going to accept it. I'm going to enter a plea. And even if he preserved, you know, his rights and other issues or something, why would he then step in and withdraw it? And that is if he doesn't even want to appeal. And if he does appeal on some issues, and, you know, let's say the appellate process takes 3 years, and he's in for 8 or 9, as I understand the policy as it's offered here, the INS policy is that deportations you start only after the defendant has served a sentence or at the very end of the sentence. So it could be he had a 10-year sentence. I mean, why would he raise it on direct appeal necessarily if there's no – how can he show during that time period that 10 years from now they're going to deport him? I mean,
I don't disagree. I mean, it all ties into the requirement of likely to result in the defendant's burden. I agree. I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying that this notion of the timeliness of the plea withdrawal motion itself is one that's out there. And, again, we're conceding – we're not arguing in this case that his motion wasn't timely. But we're just concerned that there may be a situation where somebody who could have brought knew that the consequence, and but maybe that's a case-by-case thing.
But your timeliness dovetails with the retroactivity, because you say, well, it's not in the pipeline. Well, maybe there was no reasonable person that would ever put the darn thing in the pipeline because they got a good deal, you know? And maybe, you know, so I just... there's that disconnect. Why, if he got a good deal, would he do it? Why would it be in the pipeline?
Well, I think we're talking about a case where, in order for the defendant to meet his burden of showing likely to result in, there would have to be something there that would suggest that there was deportation consequences coming. I'm suggesting, perhaps, as in this case, where somebody knows, even though there isn't the oral deportation warning given, but if there's a plea questionnaire, as there was in these cases, and if there was, and actually there was also a prior case that in which the oral deportation warning was given, that occurred a few months before the first of these other cases in which it wasn't given, that if the defendant knows about those consequences or those potential consequences and then doesn't do anything, even though he or she has pled to an aggravated felony. I mean, this is a naughty problem, and that's why we're conceding it. But that in that situation, that if they, you know, if they know that there is a rule that there should be an oral deportation warning and it wasn't given, somebody's got to figure that out for them, or they have counsel, or they have to figure it out. It seems to me they also, if they're a non-citizen and know they're a non-citizen and now have been warned on a plea questionnaire, or from the counsel or whatever the source might be, that the time for them to act to remedy that defective plea colloquy could be sooner than right at the end of their custody.
But may not be within the time of the direct appeal, and that's what you're arguing.
I don't disagree. I mean, maybe direct appeal isn't the point where that should be done. I'm just saying that there could be situations where, even under the state's reasonable due diligence type of test for the timing of the motion, that direct appeal might be a point in a particular case. The reason I sent the letter in part was because this is a difficult on the timing part, but I guess I disagree that it is critical to the retroactivity analysis, which I'd like to turn to next if I've answered your question the best I could, I think.
I disagree with you. I think it is hand in glove as to the retroactivity, so I welcome your comments on retroactivity.
Okay. The State would ask this Court to hold that the no harmless error rule, automatic plea withdrawal rule of Duang Mala, applies only to cases that were in the direct appeal pipeline. In other words, only cases that were on direct appeal at the time the decision was issued in Duang Mala, and of course that would encompass future cases as well. The effect on this petitioner.
Are there any such cases?
I'm sorry?
Are there any such cases?
I'm not aware of any that were pending on direct appeal at that time. I'm not aware of any.
They should have gone through the pipeline by now.
Probably right.
All right. Okay.
The effect on this case is that because all three of the petitioner's cases had become final, and I don't think there's a question that they were final before Duang Mala was decided, that the petitioner's cases, plea withdrawal, should be governed by pre-Duang Mala law, which recognized harmless error analysis. And even further, that is that if the defendant who pled guilty actually knew of the deportation consequences about which he was supposed to be also orally informed, that plea withdrawal is not warranted. That's the pre-Duang Mala state of the law. Now, to get to that conclusion that it should apply only to cases in the direct appeal pipeline, I think there's a five-level process, if you will, of retroactivity to be followed. The first question is whether the holding of Duang Mala is civil or criminal in nature. And I don't think there's any question that this was a criminal case we're talking about. We're not in the civil arena of retroactivity, but rather governed by the criminal analysis of retroactivity. In Wisconsin, there's still a difference. Under the federal system, the retroactivity analysis is the same for criminal and civil, but in Wisconsin, they're different. The second question, after concluding that it's criminal, is whether the holding in Duang Mala is substantive or procedural. Substantive criminal law for retroactivity purposes is that which declares which acts are crimes and prescribes the punishment, therefore, such as legalizing conduct previously considered illegal. Procedural, and for an example, in State versus Lowe, this Court decided at the end of last term, even when this Court redefined the State's burden to disprove an affirmative defense, such holding was not seen as substantive change for retroactivity analysis. Procedural criminal law, by comparison, is that which provides or regulates the steps by which one who violates a criminal statute is tried or punished. I don't think there's been any dispute, as I understand, Mr. Mwange, that this is that Duang Mala dealt with procedural criminal law. We're talking about resolving post-conviction motions for plea withdrawal in the assessment of whether harmless error applies. That's classically procedural in nature. The third level, the third step in this analysis, then, is whether Duang Mala, the procedural criminal law, criminal rule of Duang Mala, is new or old. And again, here I think it should be pretty evident that we're talking about a new rule. Teague versus Lane defines new rule in the following way. A case, quote, a case amounts as a new rule if the result was not dictated by precedent existing at the time the defendant's conviction became final. Certainly at the time Duang Mala was decided, we had at least four, Court of Appeals decisions that applied harmless error analysis to a failure to give an oral deportation warning. Duang Mala, in effect, overruled, and clearly expressly overruled, those four cases. In fact, by comparison, again, in Lowe, this Court concluded that a decision that simply modified a prior case, nevertheless, was a new rule for retroactivity analysis. Another example of this is also the Schmelzer case, where there was a pre-existing statutory right to counsel when this Court addressed Schmelzer, and when it expressly recognized that, it nonetheless, even though that was a pre-existing right, nonetheless held that the rule announced in Schmelzer that there was a right to counsel for petitions, to file petitions for review, announced a new rule of criminal procedure that would not be applied retroactively. If, as the state argues, Duane Mala states a new procedural criminal rule, then it's governed by the general test that it should not be applied retroactively. And that's State versus Koch, K-O-C-H, and Griffith versus Kentucky is the federal case that states that test. And Wisconsin law, as I understand it, is the same as the federal test. That's the general pipeline rule, that if a case announces a new rule of criminal procedure, it only applies to those cases pending on direct review or not yet final when the rule is announced. The last two steps in the analysis are the Teague exceptions. There are two of those. Those are exceptions to against the general rule of non-retroactivity. There are reasons for applying a new criminal procedure rule retroactively. The first is the primary activity exception, which states that if the new rule provides constitutional protection to a primary activity that is beyond the power of the criminal lawmaking authority to proscribe, it may be applied retroactively when raised on collateral review. That's the first of the Teague exceptions. The second of the Teague exceptions is if the new rule requires observance of procedures implicit in the conduct of ordered liberty, and that seems to be where the debate is at the moment, it may be applied retroactively when raised on collateral review. That's the ordered liberty exception. In Howard, this court observed that the primary activity exception of Teague covers what is classically substantive criminal law. Again, referring to Lowe, this court said that redefining the state's burden on a defense claim of imperfect self-defense from an objective standard of reasonable belief to a subjective standard of actual belief does not fit the primary activity exception for retroactivity. The objective, the former standard, the one that was being changed, modified, was not beyond the power of the criminal lawmaking authority to proscribe. Even more, in Teague, the Supreme Court said that a new rule requiring application of the fair cross-section requirement to the petite jury does not accord constitutional protection to any primary activity whatsoever, and thus does not require retroactive application to collateral cases. Turning then to the, that's the primary activity exception. Turning then to the ordered liberty exception. According to Teague, the ordered liberty exception is to be, quote, to be reserved for watershed rules of criminal procedure, unquote. To apply retroactively to cases on collateral review, the new criminal procedural rule must, again quoting Teague, alter our understanding of the bedrock procedural elements that must be found to vitiate the fairness of a particular conviction, unquote. As the Teague Court observed, it is doubtful that any new such components of due process have yet to be uncovered.
So there are no exceptions.
Well, never say no, I guess, but there
first
could.
First one's substantive, so it falls under the other rule. And the second one is we got them all now, so that's gone too. We have them all.
Pretty much, it sounds like.
So no exceptions.
Pretty much, it sounds like. But it leaves the door open that there may be such a case.
Is this one?
I would say no. And the reason I would say.
With deportation, I mean, that's.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that unless the court were to revisit the conclusions that have been issued in, I guess the Court of Appeals were the cases that I'm thinking of, Santos and Baeza, that deportation is a collateral consequence, so that it's not an unconstitutional imperative, unless that's revisited and changed. I mean, I'm not aware, I guess, of any cases elsewhere that have held that a plea is not knowing and voluntary if that deportation warning is not given or not knowing.
I think the legislature drafted the statute in that way and said you got to do it. That's not the usual statute.
That's true.
Sometimes one of our rules, but not the usual statute.
That's true. It's certainly a suggestion that it is of some importance. But again, I don't know of cases that suggest that it rises to a constitutional requirement for a valid plea. Again, because it's not going to that underlying conviction, I guess, is what I'm saying. And of course.
But it goes to the sentence. The sentence
well,
here,
in the
broadly speaking, is.
Well, I don't. True.
I mean, it's in the discretion of INS. It's not on the judge's hands.
That's
or
true.
This court's hands. But
that's true.
The sentence.
That's true. But I would suggest that we're.
Doesn't the judge have to always tell what the sentence is?
The maximum and minimum possible sentence is correct. But again, we're talking about whether this is a significant enough, I guess, consequence that it should be part of the constitutional requirement for a valid plea. And again, I guess I don't know of a case that says it is.
Why do you have to say it's a constitutional requirement? Why isn't it just a statutory requirement mandated by the legislature?
Well, it is a statutory requirement. It certainly is. The question, though, is the failure to do something orally, even though the defendant knows exactly what we're talking about, knows those consequences, whether that is not good enough to keep the plea. In other words, should the plea be withdrawn if he doesn't, even if he knows?
Dwagmala said no.
And Dwagmala said no. But that was a clear departure from exist from 9 years' worth, and actually, of course, the statute was even older than that, I think about 16 years old. I think it goes to 85 or 86. But it wasn't until about 93 or so when the first of the Court of Appeals decisions expressly said that harmless error analysis applies.
So because a court erred in interpreting the statute, that's what we should hang our hat on.
Well, I'm not sure it's quite that simple. We're talking about a change in a procedural rule. It's a new procedural determination of what's going to happen when on post-conviction review when we look at these plea withdrawal motions. And I would suggest that this is even further removed from the criminal conviction and the validity of the conviction than many other new rules of criminal procedure that this Court recently has said will not be applied retroactively. In addition to Lowe, one other example at least, State versus Huebner, this Court said that its holding, finding the statute that provided for the six-person jury for misdemeanors, was unconstitutional, but that nevertheless it did not satisfy the ordered liberty exception. And I think in the brief there are discussion of other cases that the Supreme Court, for example, Powers versus Ohio, the challenge to a strike of a juror on racial grounds was not of the ordered liberty. That change in the law that said a defendant doesn't have to be of the same race as a juror was not of the ordered liberty exception. And I guess that's all I have, unless there are additional questions.
I hear none, and Justice Sykes will not be participating in this case, as you can tell from the vacant chair. Thank you, Ms. I'm sorry, Justice Bradford.
Tell me why the retroactivity analysis, specifically that portion of it that focuses on the pipeline, should be applied here or in cases such as this, when the norms of being in the pipeline don't or may not exist. That is, number one, no incentive to appeal. Number two, no incentive to raise the issue on appeal if there is a lengthy sentence. And, of course, apparently the INS policy is not to even think of deportation proceedings until the end of the sentence, period. So the norm for pipeline just doesn't work. Can you respond to that? I really need help with that.
I understand, and I think I tried a little earlier, and that was... I guess it's the difference between, you know, we're talking about a situation where to avoid application of the, that the no harmless error rule was the law, and until somebody decided that they were going to challenge that, that the law was that if you knew it, there was no reason, even if the circuit court didn't tell you about what you already knew, that there was no reason for you to get relief, since if you really were concerned about those consequences that you knew, you had a remedy to seek plea withdrawal or to do something in that federal context to take care of that situation. This is a situation of who's going to be the one who's going to say we need to change this. And until that time, I guess, and there was no reason, and the courts were consistent in holding that if somebody knew the actual consequences, they couldn't be harmed if they knew those potential consequences. So, you know, should it really matter? I mean, it's a good safety net to have the court say it. The legislature is saying that's the case. But there are a lot of things that are even constitutional requirements under the Bangert test where if the court doesn't do it, but the defendant knows it, this doesn't really answer quite what you're getting at, but I'm trying to get at it in a way that I guess articulates what the state's concern here is, and is the departure from precedent that seemed pretty clearly aimed at addressing, you know, whether this defendant really has been harmed. I know that's not really quite answering what you're saying, and I don't know that I guess I need to think beyond what I'm capable of doing just at this moment to answer it better than that, so I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Fryman.
Was counsel ineffective in this case in not getting the court to have a direct conversation with the defendant?
Just because of not having the direct conversation, I would say no. I mean, if counsel had talked about the defendant and ensured, for example, that the defendant knew it, and according to the plea questionnaires, that was apparently the case, that counsel went over the questionnaire, the defendant acknowledged to the trial courts that counsel had done so, that, and especially in the world of the pre-Duangmala case law that says it, you know, be harmless if the court didn't do it, I can't see why failure of counsel merely to call the court's attention to that warning would be ineffective assistance. I'm sorry, Seth.
Thank you, Mr. Brymuth. Attorney Mwangi.
Thank you, Justice Abrahamson. The only thing to add to that is that we concede that it is a concern that is legitimate that retroactivity, if it is permitted in this case, threatens or raises concerns about retroactivity in other spheres. But I don't believe that it should be a concern because this is a very unique area. The legislature, as has been pointed out by the court, coined a remedy that's very unique, which follows a mandate that has not changed since the statute was enacted in 1985, its effective date, April 24th of 86, and for years until 1993, it remained the same until the Court of Appeals in Chavez interpreted it for the first time, and then until Duangmala, nobody said anything else about it, and the statute remains the way it was enacted to this date. And so It is a very unique statute. It expresses the legislative intent very clearly. It's not ambiguous. I think drafting doesn't get any clearer than that. The warning is in quotation marks, and as this court has held, harmless error analysis has no place there, and so it leaves you with this really gem of a statute that doesn't really require much tinkering with, and I don't believe the concerns about retroactivity, say with the firearms warning and those kinds of things, are really things we should be concerned about. I think this is very unique. Duangmala is a very, I think, very clear decision. It really tells you exactly what you want to know about what this court held. And I don't believe if this court holds for my client and vacates these convictions, there's going to be a floodgate of other cases in which everybody's suddenly looking for retroactivity in every area of law in this, you know, in this area of criminal law. I don't believe that there is other issues that are like this. This is very unique, and the uniqueness, again, goes back to the legislature highlighting deportation, you know, exclusion from admission, and denial of naturalization under federal law. Those are very unique things which affect very specific individuals. Not everybody can get this relief. You have to show you're likely to be deported, you're likely to be denied admission, and you're likely to be denied naturalization. How many people can claim that? Citizens can't. So defendants who are citizens cannot play with this. This court has held in Duangmala, you have to prove that you've done three things. Bring the appropriate motion, show the court violated the statute by not warning you, show the likelihood of a consequence.
What is the effect of the gentleman's fourth conviction on the scenario that you outlined of his going and applying for a green card at the embassy in Lagos?
It can be waived, Justice Prosser, because
it can be
waived.
Waived.
He can apply for a hardship waiver because he is the brother or sister or son of a United States citizen. He's permitted that one, and he can waive it. His problem is he has these others. And that's why he was deported. And this is the problem, because we have been debating this issue of when does the INS swoop down to get you, and we're focusing on people in detention. And that's really, I think, an error, because those are not the only people threatened with deportation. As I alluded to earlier, and Justice Jackson, I think, put it best in his dissent, in 1951 in Jordan versus DeGeorge, crimes involving moral turpitude, and you don't get deported if you have one. If you have two or more, not arising out of a single scheme of criminal misconduct. One could happen in 99, and the other could happen in 1997, and then you have a traffic stop because of a broken taillight, and Attorney General Ashcroft has deputized local law enforcement because of September 11. If you chance upon a non-citizen, you got to ask them and then call the INS to see if they need this person. They check the NCIC database, see he's been convicted, deportation. And so now it's an issue which it wasn't before. And so how does this figure into the other? Well, he is deported of that one, but that's waivable. But for the people who have these two, which are separated by time, they didn't serve any sentence, but now they encounter the INS under what was a traffic stop for something minor, now are facing deportation and they need to vacate because they never had that as part of the bargain.
So the real issue is not letting people out of prison or retrying them. And it's not bringing them back from whatever country they've been deported to. It's that the next stop, the next time an alien is picked up, whether legal or illegal, that the ability to open up a prior conviction when no warning was given, which is the key issue as you see it, so that you give people at least an opportunity to forestall deportation.
Justice, Chief Justice Abrahamson, that's what keeps me awake at night, worrying about people who thought they were getting 2 years of probation, and suddenly, in addition to 2 years of probation,
they bought deportation.
They're getting banishment for the rest of their lives. And if you don't permit them to vacate, then the sentence was not just 2 years of probation, lifetime of banishment was also part of the sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Mwangi. You carry great weight on your shoulders, and you did a very good job for your first time, and you were up against a multi-player here twice today, two out of three cases, who does a very good job on behalf of the state.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice.
I thank you both for your arguments today. And that ends our hearing on 02-2137 at SEC, State versus Lagundoya. And we are in recess, and we will be back in oral argument in a week. Now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.